Lord, as we turn our attention once again to your word here in the Old Testament, as we make our way through the Bible, book by book, chapter by chapter, and as best we can, verse by verse by verse, would you speak to our hearts? And once again, kind of per the norm in our prayer request here at Calvary Chapel, speak to our minds too. The ways that we need to alter our thinking. And that impacts so much of what we do and why we do it. So much of how we approach you even and why we approach you. How our faith kind of functions as we think through what your word has declared. And we decide, I'm either going to believe this or I am not. And so that's the part of us that really needs the most work, that needs the most, I suppose, discipline and discipleship from your spirit. The will inside of us. That decision-making part of us. So here we are. We've already decided to be here on a cold Wednesday evening, to open the Bible, to be together, to enjoy some fellowship. So thank you that we can do all of this. Would you bless our time? Or how about this, Lord? Our prayer request is probably more accurately this. Would you continue to bless our time? We're blessed just by being here. And would you continue the blessing as we're gathered together to study your word? In Jesus' name, amen. All right, 1 Kings, the 5th chapter. I'll start with Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 7 says this. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Now, who we're going to be introduced to in this chapter is not an enemy of King Solomon, but he's not of the company of Israel. Just kind of a parallel with this in the New Testament. Actually, this is a little bit of homework for you Wednesday night people. You can do a word study on the phrase, those who are outside. Those who are outside, in particular if you study this in the New King James, those who are on the outside. And you'll find passages such as 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 7, where Paul mentions to Timothy about having a good testimony among those who are outside. And outside what? Outside the church, outside the company of saints, outside the believing family of God. You would also find in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, walk properly towards those who are outside. And I mention all of this with the Proverbs and as well as the New Testament, really because of our text and what we see in Solomon's... this is so important. I'm serious. Like, this first couple of verses is a sermon unto itself. How Solomon is with the outside world. And how the outside world is with Solomon. I got to stick with my notes here. I'm not going to stick with my notes just for a minute. What I've noticed, especially the last 4 or 5 years... is how many Christians are so, this is the right word to use, how many Christians are so antagonistic against the world. I mean, there's popular Calvary Chapel pastors that are really antagonistic against the world, and I can't help but think, that's fine, I'm not even arguing what their issues might be, but from the pulpit, they are definitely missing gospel opportunities, particularly towards those who are outside. If they're just griping and complaining about what the world does, I don't believe that they're having a good testimony. And that's, I don't know if that's an accusation I'm making. It's just, it's more of an observation. You really have a great opportunity to not have a good testimony among those who are outside when all you're doing is griping about everything that they do, even if you're right. So, verse 1. Now Hiram, or Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon because he heard that they had anointed him king in the place of his father, for Hiram had always loved David. I'm telling you, I love this so much. Obviously, certainly not an enemy of Israel, but obviously outside the nation of Israel. And Hiram, he loved King David. And just some quick application I think is found in this about being both upright in the world, right? We have to have that good testimony, which includes us being solid Christians, naming the name of Jesus, but also being a blessing, once again, instead of constantly complaining about the world and complaining, or all about, it's more like this, being a complaining thorn in the side of the world for non-gospel reasons. At any rate, David had that, and Solomon apparently has that as well. So Hiram loved King David. Then verse 2, Solomon sent to Hiram saying, "You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God because of the wars which were fought against him on every side until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet." So notice this in his letter. I love the first little bit of that there in verse 3. What does he say? "You know." Like, how would this pagan king know? Clearly he and David had a bit of a relationship. So you know this. And David, my dad, was not able to build this because essentially, you remember this, when the Lord met with him, he had blood on his hands. Like, "You're not going to build this, your son will." But now, verse 4, "The Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor evil occurrence. And behold, I propose to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, 'Your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, he shall build the house for my name. And now, therefore, command that they cut down cedars for me from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants, and I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say. For you know there is none among us who has skill to cut timber like the Sidonians.'" I got to tell you, I love this too. Even just that little blurb there. "My servants will be with your servants. They're going to work side by side." And so I know this is an issue for so many Christians, and it's been an issue through the ages for Christians. Like, what's spiritual and what's secular? Like, this is the spiritual part of my life, you know, Sunday mornings, Wednesday nights, whatever, when I'm praying, but everything else is secular. When I'm at work, there's nothing spiritual about that. Or what if there is? What if you can actually be very spiritual when you're in a secular environment? I remember this years ago, one of our old interns had a question for me, came into my, you know, my office. "Pastor Jeremy, can I talk to you?" So I'm, "Sure, of course, come on in." A question about discipleship. And he said, "You know, how come there's not more discipleship here at the Bible college?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm not sure what exactly you're asking me here, but it's almost, what kind of discipleship would you like to have? And explain to me what is not discipleship. Like, us having this conversation right now here in my office, this is actually some discipleship. You coming to classes is discipleship. Us coming to church. Us even having meals together, is that discipleship? Think of Jesus and the 12 and Jesus and the disciples, the broader group, 60, 70, all the women that were there too. They met together. They broke bread together. There was discipleship that happened. And so, well, that's just secular stuff. No, but it can be very spiritual. And I was saying to this intern, it was Monty, by the way, but I was saying to him, like, what if we were to go to a basketball game together? And just, well, that can't be. Why not? I mean, Jesus was with the guys and they went everywhere. There was no basketball in the first century, but what did they go through the market together? Well, yeah. Did they do normal everyday stuff together? So could we go to a basketball game, and would that be not discipleship? No, that wouldn't be. Like, well, why not? What if we were able in public? How can we conduct ourselves as godly Christians and be in the world but not of the world? And I love this. Again, it's a lot to say about just this simple idea, but my servants will be with your servants. They're going to serve side by side. And this is spiritual in the midst of the secular. And it's secular in the midst of what? The super spiritual, because they're building what? The temple. Like, wait, wait, wait. Those are Gentile dudes over there. Are you serious? You're going to have them involved in that? Yes. It's interesting. Just, we tend to write people off where they're Christians, so I have no conversation with them. What if we had conversations with people? By the way, this is a real practical thing, but I love this not just for ministry lessons, but for normal life lessons too. You notice what he says here in verse 6, and this is his letter that he writes to King Hiram. "I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say." Okay, what's the big deal? He's not asking for a discount. This is the Lord's work, so we want to do it on the cheap. No, like, we want to pay you whatever you need to be paid to do this. And I find this here at the church a lot. Like, if someone says, "Well, we'll do that for you because it's you know, it's the church." Look, I'm not asking for, you know, for a discount on behalf of the church here at Calvary Chapel. I'm not asking you for a discount. If you want to give me a discount, that's between you and the Lord. But I am not asking. I have to pay someone to do this work, and we're asking. We approached you. We're asking you to do this work, not because we think we can get it on the cheap, because God's not broke. You know, And I love that he just respects this man enough to say, you tell me what you need to pay and what you need me to pay, and I'll pay it. And I think this whole interaction, this letter, he's complimentary, and especially complimentary where he says at the end, for you know there is none among us who has skill to cut timber like the Sidonians. It's complimentary. It's showing genuine respect to those who are on the outside. So Hiram has a reaction and then a response letter, verse 7. So it was when Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he read the letter, that he rejoiced greatly and said, this is not his letter, this is just kind of him speaking out loud. Listen to this from this pagan dude. Blessed be the Lord, all caps. That's Yahweh, that's the covenant name of Israel. Blessed be the Lord this day, for he has given David a wise son over this great people. You see how that works? The respect from a believer concerning the house of God towards the non-believing world, and he's impacted by this. So then his letter, his response, then Hiram sent to Solomon saying, I have considered the message which you sent me, and I will do all you desire concerning the cedar and cypress logs. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you indicate to me. You just tell me where. And we'll have them broken apart there. Then you can take them away, and you shall fulfill my desire by giving food for my household. So the paycheck that I'd like from you, King Solomon, just feed me. It would be great. And I wonder, with how respectful Solomon was, this is just me wondering. This is not in the text. And so this is just, it's not even an opinion. It's actually me just thinking out loud here. I wonder how many conversations he might have had with Hiram about the true and living God because of his attitude towards him. And again, part of the reason I wonder that is verse 3. You know how my father David could not build this house. They had this relationship. They had this connection. And I just wonder. I wonder how we would be if we'd be courteous at the very least, and respectful and complimentary. Well, it's just secular stuff, and those are just pagans. If we'd actually treat people well, the opportunities for genuine gospel witness, I'm just thinking out loud and I wonder. David was loved by this man. They had a wonderful relationship. And I just imagine, knowing David, he was probably the kind of guy to say, hey, let me tell you about the true and living God, Hiram. Verse 10, then Hiram gave Solomon cedar and cypress logs according to all his desire, as much as he needed. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20 cores of pressed oil. Thus Solomon gave to Hiram year by year. Verse 12, so the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he had promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty together. It sounds like a good relationship. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel, and the labor force was 30,000 men. That's what was going to happen when they appointed a king, that he was going to pull people to do that kind of work. So 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home, not a bad schedule. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. And Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens and 80,000 who quarried stones in the mountains. So there's just so much work that had to be done for the temple. Besides, verse 16, 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. And the king, verse 17, commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, and hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. And so Solomon's builders, Hiram's builders, and the Gebalites, they quarried them, and they prepared timber and stones to build the temple. And yes, I'm harping on this quite a bit, but if you were wondering about the Hebrew word there in verse 12 in your text for peace, as the two of these great men were at peace, yes, the Hebrew word is shalom. This is a genuine peace that they had. It's a beautiful thing here. Chapter 6. Came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel in the months of Ziv, which is in the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. There's several things about verse 1 as well. If you remember from 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 1 through 7, the Lord let David know, like, I don't need a house. I don't need this. God never needed a temple. And yet he's instructing Solomon to do this. It's a fascinating kind of thing because on one hand, it's like, it's way more for his people than for him. He doesn't need it. At the same time, this is kind of a funny thing to me because this is 480 years after they left Egypt. Like, what took you so long? What have you been doing with all your time that you... I don't know. That's a whole other conversation, I suppose. But here's the other thing, and this is for you, like, real Bible nerds with this kind of stuff, if you're interested. This is a big old, by the way, verse 1 also provides for us some historic markers. If we're correct, historically speaking, Solomon's reign began in 97 BC. And so as it says here, this is 4 years into his reign. So the temple project begins in 967. Then based on the data that's provided here, this actually dates the Exodus for us. And the Exodus happened then in the year 1447 BC. If you're curious, that's just one of those interesting kind of notes and the historic accuracy of the word. So at any rate, this is the dating for it. Verse 2, now the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, its length was 60 cubits, its width 20, and its height 30 cubits. This is a great Wednesday night because you get a little bit of history and you get a little bit of math. Thank you for coming on a Wednesday night for just a great all-around lesson in various subjects. And so the math in your own personal Bible study, because no, nobody uses cubits anymore. And what exactly is a cubit? Thank you so much for asking. I appreciate this. And really, if you get like a ruler or something, measure this, and it's almost exactly this from your elbow to like your fingertips is nearly 18 inches. Foot and a half. And, you know, there's some people with longer... I mean, where's Nate? Where are those... Tall guy, so he's going to have longer arms. There's some basketball players that have, like, a wingspan of about 9 foot. So their cubit is probably not accurate. So there would have been a standard cubit. So that's roughly 18 inches. Call that a foot and a half. So whenever we're doing this kind of measurement here, and if you really want to work it out, you're welcome to it, it's the measurement plus half the measurement. So 60 cubits here. It'd be the 60 plus half of 60 is 30. So this is about 90 feet. Okay, that's more helpful than 60 cubits. And if you really want to get your head around this a little bit, our building, just the front side of the building, and I suppose the back side too, the way it cuts there, but this side of the building is 50 by 60, and in the middle of the building, it's 60 by 50. 50 by 60, 60 by 50. That's why it's a little bit of an L. So the front of it, if it were both 60 by 60, it'd be 120, but it's minus the 10, so it's 110. So the front of our building is 110 feet. And the temple here is 90, as being described. So it just gives you a little bit of concept of how big this structure was. Also tells us that the width was 20 cubits. So mathematicians, 30 feet. Well done. You get a sticker for that. And the height, 30 cubits, 45. So pretty tall, actually. And a 90 by 20 structure, check my math, 1,800 square feet, and a super tall structure. There you go. That's the math for tonight. So verse 3, the vestibule in front of the sanctuary of the house was 20 cubits long, 30 feet, across the width of the house. And the width of the vestibule extended 10 cubits, 15 feet roughly, from the front of the house. And he made for the house windows with beveled frames. And the vestibule, of course, would be more of like a covered porch of sorts there. And this is like the entryway or the entry hall. In fact, probably a lot of churches call the entryway the vestibule. Anyone raised in a church where it's like vestibule? How many foyer people? Or foyer? Foyer, foyer, vestibule, or I don't know, entryway, whatever. Like that's where the front door of the church, right? So that's the concept there. And you guys can argue foyer and foyer later on your own time. Verse 5, against the wall of the temple, he built chambers all around, against the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctuary. Thus he made side chambers all around it. The lowest chamber, verse 6, was 5 cubits wide. The middle was 6 cubits wide, and the third was 7 cubits wide, for he made narrow ledges around the outside of the temple so that the supported beams would not be fastened into the walls of the temple. Do what you want to do with that. It's an interesting little notation there at the end of verse 6. And I'm not even sure that all of your translations render it exactly this way, but that the support beams would not be fastened into the walls of the temple. So these chambers or storerooms, and no doubt these storerooms would have also been used for the priests as like dressing rooms when they arrived to their time of to be on duty at the temple. And perhaps even the priests ate of their portions of the holy offerings in those rooms. So either way, it's not fastened to the walls. Is this just a super practical thing to not weaken the main structure? Is it spiritual that even good, necessary, practical things were not to impose upon that which is holy? Where I'm saying to be very careful with some of these little details. Skip down to verse 10 for a second. It says, and he built side chambers against the entire temple, each 5 cubits high, and they were attached to the temple with cedar beams. So be careful that you don't over-spiritualize stuff that doesn't need to be spiritualized. Is there a reason for it? I'm sure there was a reason for it. Do we get to know that? I'm sure we don't. Are you welcome to speculate? Go crazy. But go crazy within the confines of even a couple verses later. These were attached. So just be careful with your Bible reading. Not everything needs to have some great spiritual truth. Verse 7, in the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone finished at the quarry. Notice this. So that, this is the reason for it, so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was what? Heard in the temple while it was being built. I mean, I've never worked with cutting stone with iron chisels. That's just never been a job that I've had. But I'd imagine that there'd be some volume to that. This really, verse 7 is pretty amazing to me. The temple, of course, is a model of the heavenly temple. We'll come back to that in just a couple mentions of it in a little while. But even while it's being built, the call is for peace, quiet, reverence. No sound, of course, obviously, you know, no building sound, no construction sound. But even related to that, though it doesn't say it, neither would you find dust and debris. There's no clutter. But the sound was the main thing. The sound clutter. You ever have that in life? Like, just in a quiet spot. Josh, do you remember this when we were in Israel, this in Jake 2, right? Where we're, Nate, or who am I missing? But we're there, and when you go to some of these old churches, by old we mean several hundred-year-old churches, and you could just go and sit down in these. And it's quiet. And there's this sense of, in our culture, we just don't do that anymore. We're not very good at just finding quiet. I mean, it's the temple, so we got to get the work done because we need the temple to build. No, do that work over there. This place where the temple is going to stand, we don't need to have that noise clutter. And what fascinates me, and it's a little bit of a side note to this whole thing, but this is, it's we're told here, the so that in verse 7, right in the middle of it, clarifies that there is not to be any sound of all of that stuff. And isn't this how God most often seems to work in us and seems to speak to us in the quiet? Isn't that Psalm 46 and verse 10? Be still and know that I am God. Quiet, but he's not doing nothing. The work out of view at the quarry was full on boisterous. Guys chopping away at rock and cutting rock and moving rock and all that stone that was happening. But at the temple, and even as I do this right now, it's a little bit uncomfortable, isn't it? Just like we're not very good at that. But this is where they were going to meet with the Lord, and just we don't need all that extra sound. Start to be comfortable with some of that quiet with the Lord. Verse 8 tells us the doorway for the middle story was on the right side of the temple. And they went up by stairs to the middle story, because that's how that works, and from the middle to the third. So he built the temple and finished it, and he paneled the temple with beams and boards of cedar. So, as we'll see here, and we've kind of seen a little bit to this point here in chapter 6, there's four main components to the temple. There's the temple itself, the actual building. There's this vestibule kind of area that's like this covered porch. There's this three-story section of side chambers. And then we'll see in verse 36 and a little bit here, there's this just large courtyard. So it wasn't just the building, but there's all these other components that went into this is where you would go to worship the Lord. It's also worth the mention, in fact, hold your place here and just turn a couple books to the right. We're going to turn to a couple places tonight. 2 Chronicles chapter 3. What we're not told here, we are told in 2 Chronicles. Make sure I have the right, yes, scripture address. 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1. In our section, we're not told the where, but we are here. Now Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, or Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Anything else happened on Mount Moriah? Oh, you might remember Genesis chapter 22. You might remember Genesis chapter 22 verses 1 and 2 where the Lord tested Abram. Go and take your son, your only son whom you love, and there sacrifice him on a hill that I will show you in the land of Moriah on a particular hill, on a particular mountain. Spend some time in Genesis 22. Oh, I don't know anything else that would happen there later after Solomon's time on another part of this same hill. The Lamb of God slain there. Moriah, Mount Moriah. Back here in our text, 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 11. Then the word of the Lord came to Solomon, saying, concerning this temple which you are building, verse 12, if you walk in my statutes, execute my judgments, keep all my commandments, and walk in them, then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David, and I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will not forsake my people Israel. Obviously, this is conditional. It's certainly that. It was dependent upon, for the Israelites, dependent upon what? Their obedience. Do the right stuff. This is what we need you to do. This is what I need you to do. Do those things. And much of the same was spoken to David, as you know, there's this connections to him speaking to David about this, and you find that same conversation in 2 Samuel chapter 7. What you also find in this whole conversation and kind of lengthy conversation, here's the Lord making these promises to David and then reiterating some of that to Solomon about all of this. You find the promise of his continual mercy. And that's a beautiful thing, isn't it? The promise of his continual mercy for his people, for the Jews. But that's actually pretty telling, isn't it? His continual mercy? Why do you need, when do you need mercy? When you sinned, there's wrongdoing, there are shortcomings, or as is in the text here, what he's discussing with him, when there's disobedience. It's not, you'll never be my people again, I'm done with you. It's, no, there'll be mercy. But blessings, I'll tell you, we have it so good on this side of the new covenant with the grace of God. And because of the grace of God, all the more that we should walk in obedience to what he's declared to us. And the great blessing even here in our text there in verse 13, that he would dwell with them. In the same conversation with David in 2 Samuel 7, he would dwell with them, be with them, reside with them. It's fascinating in the bigger picture as the temple is, you know, at this point it's built, but it's still waiting to be finished. There's all this we're going to finish here, chapter 6, and we're going to look at so much of the gold that went over and whatnot. But the pagan gods, small g, they needed a place to live. Not so for the Lord. Once again, this was the blessing from Him for His people more than from His people to Him. Like, we got to build you a house. I never needed a house. I'm fine without one. I want to have you. I want you to build it because I'm going to dwell. I am dwelling with you, but I want to have a place where you can meet with me specifically. It wasn't for Him. It was for them. And I mentioned this a few moments ago, and just a quick mention of this. The temple would have been the model of the heavenly temple. If you really want to dig into this, spend time in Hebrews chapter 8 and Hebrews chapter 9. Like, what does the temple in heaven look like? Not this 90 foot by, 40 by 45 foot tall. It's not that, but just everything that happened and everything that went into that, how it was. It was a model of the heavenly. And that's a whole other conversation in itself. Verse 14, so Solomon built the temple and finished it. And he built the inside walls of the temple with cedar boards. From the floor of the temple to the ceiling, he paneled inside with wood. And he covered the floor of the temple with planks of cypress. All that wood that Hiram was going to provide, where was it going to go? Here we are. Verse 16, then he built the 20-cubit room, or the 30-cubit room at the rear of the temple. This would be important. From floor to ceiling with cedar boards, he built it inside as the inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. This is just how my brain works when I read this. Like, why cedar? Cedar is particularly helpful against fabric-damaging insects like moths. I mean, it actually smells really nice, too. A lot of people will make their closets out of cedar, because moths just don't bother with cedar. So it's interesting that that's how this works, but as we're about to discover, most of it's overlaid with gold. So is the cedar important for those other reasons? Apparently not, but it was specifically going to be cedar. Dig into that as much as you'd like to dig into that. Verse 17, and in front of it, the temple sanctuary was 40 cubits long, 60 feet. The inside of the temple was cedar, carved with ornamental buds and open flowers. All was cedar. There was no stone to be seen. So think about that. You're one of the guys that worked at the quarry, just working so hard, chiseling just with this great precision, outrageous precision. Then they had to bring it to Jerusalem to set it in place. And like, look at my finished work. Yeah, it looks good. Bring in the cedar. And like, you don't get to see it. Not everything needs to be seen. Some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Well, but that corner that was just so perfect. Doesn't matter. But it does. Because even if those unseen things aren't done well as unto the Lord, what difference does it make if you got pretty cedar and all these ornamental buds and whatnot, if the interior stuff, the unseen stuff, isn't straight, isn't right, isn't accurate? It's a weaker structure. It's a whole conversation itself too, isn't it? So he overlaid verse 20. Inner chamber was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold. And he overlaid the altar of cedar. I skipped verse 19. He prepared the inner sanctuary inside the temple to set the ark of the covenant of the Lord there. And then he gives the dimensions in verse 20. Verse 21, so Solomon overlaid the inside of the temple with pure gold. He stretched gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. The whole temple he overlaid with gold until he had finished all the temple. Also, he overlaid with gold the entire altar that was by the inner sanctuary. Just gold everywhere. There's a couple things about this. Obviously, gold everywhere, and we see this in verses 30 as well as verse 32. Like, even the floor and the doors, if I'm remembering correctly, overlaid with gold. Just gold everywhere. And imagine walking into that. And if you've ever been to Israel, if you've been to Jerusalem, and it's the Middle East, right? It's the Mediterranean / Middle East. And if you've ever been anywhere, if you've been to the desert, you can imagine what that would be like, just full direct sun on a gold structure. Like, how just blindingly glorious that would be. And no doubt, it was to remind them of the glory of the Lord. But here's an interesting kind of a question with this. We just read, and I'm glad I went back and read it in verse 19, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord was going to be put in there. So, okay, we're going to read about the altar, and we're going to read about some of these other implements, but those are all from where or from when? From some 480 years before this point? No. Those would be built. Chapter 7, we'll see, assuming we dig into that this evening. The furnishings would be made by Hiram, the craftsman, and Huram, the different craftsmen that Hiram would have sent. But yes, as we'll see in chapter 8 as well, probably not tonight, the Ark of the Covenant. That Ark. I still had that, and that was going to be in there. Verse 23, inside the inner sanctuary he made two cherubim. Cherubim or cherubs. You would never say cherubims. The I am indicates plurality, and cherubs was a variety of angels. So in the inner sanctuary he made two cherubs of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. 15 foot tall? Pretty tall. Verse 24, one wing of the cherub was 5 cubits, call that 7.5 feet. And the other wing of the cherub, 5 cubits, call that 7.5 feet. 10 cubits, call that 15 feet. From the tip of one wing to the tip of the other, and the other cherub was 10 cubits. Both cherubim were of the same size and shape. I'm just so impressed that I'm sure they were mirror images of each other. And we kind of know that when you keep reading. The height of one cherub was 10 cubits, and so was the other cherub. And then he set the cherubim inside the inner room, and they stretched out the wings of the cherubim so that the wing of one touched one wall, and the wing of the other cherub touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. I'm sorry if you're not impressed by that. I'm super impressed by that. Like, here's the room. Then make the cherub. Make them this tall. Make their wings exactly this, and two of them identical, and they're going to fit in the room. And when they get in the room, boop, that wing touches that wall. Boop, that wing is right square in the middle. And boop, the other one touches the wall and touches. Not like, yeah, we're going to have to jam that. I don't think they were jamming anything into place. It was just perfect. The precision of that, it's just amazing to me. I'm sorry that I'm a little bit of a nerd with some of this, but it's amazing. So he set that in there, he set the cherubim, or those in there, verse 27, inside the inner room, and they stretched out the wings of the cherubim so that the wing of one touched one wall, and the wing of the other cherub touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. He also overlaid the cherubim with gold. More gold. Verse 29, then he carved all the walls of the temple all around, both the inner and outer sanctuaries, with carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. And the floor of the temple he overlaid with gold, both the inner and outer sanctuaries. For the entrance of the inner sanctuary he made doors of olive wood. The lintel and doorposts were 1/5 of the wall. I mean, again, this must have been not just beautiful, but overwhelmingly so. And it should have been this physical reminder of the glory of God. So he continues, verse 32, the two doors were of olive wood. And he carved on them figures of cherubim, so that everywhere you looked as you were inside there, it's fascinating, isn't it? There in verse 32, especially, cherubim, or angels, as well as palm trees, open flowers, and he overlaid them with gold, and he spread gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. Same in verse 29, carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. We'll keep reading. Verse 33, so he made the door of the sanctuary. He also made doorposts of olive wood, 1/4 of the wall. And the two doors were of cypress wood. Two panels comprised one folding door, and two panels comprised the other folding door. Then they carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them, and overlaid them with gold applied evenly on the carved work. Verse 36, he built the inner court with 3 rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beams. What's fascinating to me, and I'm not sure why, but I'm sure there's people that are sure why. Catch that? I'm not sure why. I'm sure there's people that are sure why this is the case. It's angelic, just reminders of heaven, but then palm trees, like flowers and stuff. Like, that's common. That's just earthly things. So you walk in, like, it's this crazy gold everywhere. On the floor, gold. Walls. And the carvings they made of all these things, like, angelic, that's heavenly, but there's trees. And so it was a reminder of both, interestingly enough. And I wonder, and this is just me wondering out loud, if it was a reminder from the Lord for them, especially in Old Testament concepts and Old Testament structure and just how everything worked. Here's the Lord and here's the people, but he sometimes met with them, didn't he? He met with his people. He dwelt with his people. He was willing, the heavenly, he who is divine, to meet with that which is common, that which is earthbound. So he built the inner court with the three rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beams. Verse 37, in the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Tziv. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its details and according to all its plans. So he was 7 years in building it. I mean, glorious? Yes. Amazing? Yes. Super fascinating. Like, we just want to dwell on this for a few moments here. Chapter 14. We're not going to turn to chapter 14 right now, but 5 years after Solomon's death. You might dig into that a little bit. It's plundered. And then cheap substitutes were implemented. There's all this gold like everywhere. And then in the next couple of verses there in chapter 14, I mean, it's the same book. They used bronze shields because the gold ones were plundered. It's just a few years after he's dead and everything changes. And perhaps that was the reminder of the cherubim. You know, here's that which is was great and divine and heavenly, and here's the palm trees. Here's just the earthbound kind of stuff. It's the mixture of both. You guys doing all right? We're not going to get through chapter 7 in 10 minutes. This is a good... No, we are not. We are not. So that's a good stopping point. I had hoped for 3 chapters, but that's good. Bless you guys. Thanks for being here. Keep reading. Keep reading. Keep seeing what's happening with all of this stuff. It's worth your while. And it should, while you're reading, it should remind you of Exodus and a lot of the instruction that was provided. When you build this, make it this way. When you build this, make it this way. And the precision there with that. And we'll talk about some of that the next time we dig into 1 Kings. Have a great night. Thanks for being here. See you later.